once again, it's time for another edition of Rockin' the Boat here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 on your FM dial, 91.3 on your FM dial in Olympia, Washington, and 87.9 FM in Point Arena, California on Mojo Radio. www.freakradio.org on your computer. My name's the V-Man, and today on Rockin' the Boat, we'll discuss a U.S. Department of Energy proposal to construct facilities designed to conduct biowarfare agent experiments using lethal pathogens like anthrax, plague, and botulism, being constructed at Lawrence Livermore and Los Alamos National Laboratories. And later in the show, Anti-Bees Knees looks at U.S. government procurement for contracts increasing domestic surveillance systems. Stand by, stay tuned, Rockin' the Boat coming up straight ahead here on Freak Radio Santa Cruz 96.3. For months, U.S. and coalition forces have scoured Iraq searching for biological weapons and the labs that might have made them. The possibility of these labs' existence led broadcasts around the world. Meanwhile, in the United States, with very little media attention or public discussion, the Bush administration is quietly pursuing plans to build biowarfare agent facilities of its own. The new labs will handle, modify, and experiment with some of the most harmful agents known to humanity, including live anthrax, plague, Q fever, and botulism. But what should be even more controversial is where some of these biofacilities are being built. At nuclear weapons design sites, Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in California and Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico. So begins an article titled Mixing Bugs and Bombs, which appears in the September-October 2003 issue of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in Livermore, California is a U.S. Department of Energy national lab which is managed by the University of California. Founded in September 1952, Lawrence Livermore is one of three nuclear weapons design labs operated by the Department of Energy. The others are Sandia Labs and Los Alamos, both in New Mexico. Attorneys representing a coalition of individuals and community groups located near the two labs filed a federal lawsuit today, August 26th, seeking to suspend construction of the new buildings pending a comprehensive review of the project's environmental impacts. Joining me to discuss the suit and the proposed bioweapons labs is Tara Darabji. She is a recent graduate of UC Santa Cruz and is also outreach director of Tri-Valley Communities Against a Radioactive Environment, also known as Tri-Valley Cares. Tri-Valley Cares is one of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit filed in federal court today. Also on the line with us is Stephen Volker, the plaintiff's lead public interest attorney who filed today's federal lawsuit. Thank you both for joining me tonight on Rockin' the Boat.
Thank you, Vinny.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Why don't we begin with you, Stephen. Can you describe the scope of the lawsuit that was filed today? I mentioned briefly what it was about, but can you give us a little more detail?
Yeah, sure, I'd be happy to. It's a lawsuit against the Department of Energy, the National Nuclear Security Administration, and the Lawrence Livermore and Los Alamos National Laboratories. The lawsuit was filed in the Northern District Federal Court in California this morning, and the plaintiffs are Tri-Valley Cares from the Livermore area, Nuclear Watch of New Mexico, which is located in the vicinity of the Los Alamos lab, and several individuals who reside at those locations. The relief sought in the lawsuit, is a court order barring construction of the bio research lab in Livermore and preventing operation of the bio research lab in Los Alamos. The grounds for the suit are that the Department of Energy and the other defendants violated the National Environmental Policy Act, commonly known as NEPA, by failing to prepare an EIS on each of these facilities, as well as failing to prepare a programmatic EIS on the federal government's nationwide program called the Chemical and Biological National Security Program, pursuant to which these two labs are being constructed. The lawsuit also alleges that the defendants violated the Freedom of Information Act, or FOIA, by failing to provide to the plaintiffs documents they had requested over the past year concerning the Department of Energy's plans for these facilities and alternatives to their construction, such as using existing facilities, perhaps at the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, and rethinking the need for the research entirely. We have been assigned a judge, Wayne Brazil, in the Oakland Division of the Northern District of California Federal Court, and we expect to have our first hearing before Judge Brazil in about 1 month. We will be filing a motion for preliminary injunction, which is a request to the court to issue orders barring construction and operation of these facilities, and after we obtain that relief to halt these unlawful activities, we will ask the court to affirmatively order the government to prepare these environmental impact statements both nationwide and on the local facilities.
As you mentioned, Stephen, these facilities, these proposed facilities at Livermore have yet to be built, and there's a partially constructed facility at Los Alamos. How soon before either of these buildings would be operational?
We expect they would be in operation by March or April next year.
I see. That's the voice of Stephen Volker. He's the lead attorney in a lawsuit filed today on behalf of plaintiffs. We're also joined on the line by Tara Darabji. She is the outreach coordinator for Tri-Valley Cares. Hi, Tara.
Hello.
Last year, after the arrest of Jose Padilla, the so-called dirty bomber, there was concern about the possibility of an attack on nuclear shipments or other materials, other radioactive materials. Officials at DOE and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission have said these shipments can be secured. What do you feel is the likelihood of an accident or an attack in the transportation of these bioagents, this material that's being proposed to be tested at these facilities? And what is the potential impact if such an accident were to occur?
I think that when you're talking about transporting lethal agents, including virulent live strains of anthrax, botulism, plague, automatically there's an increased risk. And I think when you look at, you're talking about an increase of shipments at both facilities initially. I believe it's something like, there'll be about as many as 11 times initially at Livermore Lab. And already, historically, Los Alamos Laboratory in New Mexico has been charged with mishandling select agents that have been delivered from to their facility. And so I think that there's a real issue specifically in the transportation. More broadly, when you're talking about using these deadly agents, specifically, in Livermore, you're talking about a densely populated area. And to put this in context for folks, the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory has a shameful history of leaks, spills, and accidents. They discharged plutonium to the city sewage system for decades. There have been tritium leaks, chlorine leaks. And so you're talking about an agency that, works on designing and developing nuclear weapons. And you look at their history, and clearly you see a general disregard. When there's accidents, there's not public transparency. Often the public is not notified, and when they're notified, there's usually a huge time lag. So I think that there's enormous potential for really dangerous accidents. And we actually, the National Resource Defense Council did some modeling about what would happen if there was a release in the Bay Area, and they used the Department of Defense models, and they found that they used different calculations with common wind patterns we see out. They used, you know, in their model scenarios, they used about 500 grams of anthrax spores. There was light damage to the facility and typical wind patterns, and made the incident occur at midday. And in one calculation under this model, they estimated that 9,000 people would likely die from this potential exposure to anthrax, and more than 200,000 would be exposed to the airborne concentration, leading to the death of 20% at that time. So you're talking about, if there is an accident, major fatalities, major casualties in the local area. And when you just stop and look at the history of operations at Livermore and Los Alamos, you see a lot of errors and a real trend of putting their public image above community safety.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk quickly about biodefense. In the wake of 9/11, there was $6 billion allocated for biodefense. Do you know how much money is going to these proposed bioweapons facilities?
For the biowarfare agent facilities at Livermore and Los Alamos, I mean, it's a piece of the pork. And I think, I mean, you bring up a good point, and overall, nationwide, you're seeing dozens and dozens of high-level biocontainment facilities proposed, over four dozen. And so, I mean, I think that's one of the real critical issues, is that you have a system where there's no coordination between agencies, an abundance of funding, and a real push to experiment with virulent agents. And what's missing is a comprehensive analysis, both within agencies and between agencies, asking for what capacities do we already have as a nation? And then at that point, decide specifically what new capacities, if any, need to be developed, and then decide where to place them. Unfortunately, what we're seeing is a national grab bag. There's a bunch of money, and everyone wants a piece of the pork. And what our lawsuit specifically asks is that the Department of Energy do their own review. You know, we're asking them to stop and think, look at the facilities that they have, look at the capacities that they have, and then decide, you know, really how they're going to work together. And I think when you look at the cursory environmental reviews that were done for the biowarfare agent facilities at both Los Alamos and Livermore, it was real, you know, indicative of this lack of looking at it programmatically, because in their initial drafts for the Livermore site and the Los Alamos site, they neglected to mention that they were actually pursuing a biowarfare agent facility at the other site. So when the Los Alamos proposal came out, they didn't mention the Livermore one. And when the Livermore one came out, it didn't mention the Los Alamos one initially. And so I think that there's a real problem in that. It's the same if one agency is proposing these sites and doesn't, you know, they don't even attempt to plan how that these sites are going to work together, how these facilities will integrate, and how overall programmatically the Department of Energy is going to integrate them. It's a real lack, and I think it places people more at risk.
That's the voice of Tara Darabji. She's Outreach Director of Tri-Valley Cares. Also on the line is Stephen Volker, the plaintiff's lead public interest attorney on this lawsuit. I know you have to drop out of the conversation shortly, Stephen, so I want to get a couple questions out to you. Talking about, Tara just mentioned the pork barrel politics here. With the full resources of the federal government available to fight this lawsuit, what do you think is the likelihood you'll be able to accomplish your goal of stopping these facilities from being constructed?
Oh, I have confidence in our federal judiciary to blow the whistle. The federal government has ignored the National Environmental Policy Act and the Freedom of Information Act. It conducted quick and dirty environmental assessments, dismissing all potential impacts without analysis, and it has stonewalled all of the FOIA, or Freedom of Information Act, requests submitted by our clients over the past year. I think a federal court would have little difficulty in finding that the federal government had violated these laws and ordering preparation of the long overdue comprehensive programmatic environmental assessment. As Tara was explaining, the federal government needs to take a step back and reassess this headlong commitment to an ill-thought-out strategy. As Tara was indicating, this strategy would greatly exacerbate the existing threat from terrorist attacks on these facilities. The more of these facilities there are, the more likely it is that one or more of them would be a magnet for a successful terrorist attack. Also, it increases the likelihood that earthquakes or fires or accidents will cause a catastrophic release of pathogens. For example, at the Lawrence Livermore Lab, the quick and dirty environmental assessment conducted by the Department of Energy asserts that the maximum credible earthquake during the 30-year life of the facility would have a G acceleration of 0.6 G. But the existing science tells us, according to published articles, that it is likely we will have earthquakes in the range of 1.0 G acceleration during the next 30 years at this location. And should one of those hit, just like the Loma Prieta hit in 1989, the results truly would be catastrophic. As Tara explained, the modeling done by Dr. McKinsey at Natural Resources Defense Council confirms that the plume of anthrax or whatever pathogen might be released would head directly to the East Bay and San Francisco with the resulting terrible loss of life. Even when other weather wind patterns were prevailing, Dr. McKinsey estimated losses in the thousands. So that's just one example of the many uncertainties that plague these proposals at both locations that warrant a very careful study. So we are confident, given the circumstances, that the federal courts will rein in the rogue officers at the Department of Energy and order them to comply with the law.
All right. Well, I know you have to probably be making your way off there, Stephen, and we do have just a few moments left for the segment, so I want to thank you for joining us, and I'll try to wrap it up here with Tara Darabji of Tri-Valley Cares.
Thank you. You're very welcome.
Thank you. Good luck with the lawsuit. And that was Stephen Volker dropping out of the conversation, plaintiff's lead public interest attorney for this lawsuit against these proposed facilities. I guess one final thought. Is it a giant leap, Tara, to suggest that if these facilities were to go forward, or just the fact that the U.S. is pursuing this program of biowarfare agents, will this spur other nations to construct their own programs, in your view?
I think that's a very important point. When you're talking about research, biodefense research, the line between offensive and defensive research is so fine. It's literally separated by intent. So whether you're doing a biodefensive operation, biodetection, or you actually have a very aggressive bioweapons program, you can actually use biodefense as a smokescreen for a bioweapons program. And I think that locating a biowarfare agent facility within the nation's nuclear weapons labs, which are super secretive. You know, they're skirting our FOIA requests. And these are already, I think, key, you know, what's key is these are already institutions involved in the development of weapons of mass destruction. So when you locate these facilities inside of a nuclear weapons lab, you're sending a very suspicious message to the international community. And I think that that's the question is, how will the international community be guaranteed that these are purely defensive programs? And, you know, I mean, Livermore Lab on site, they haven't said that there's any association with the proposed biowarfare facilities, but they do have on-site commercial-scale fermenters. And what a fermenter is you can put a culture of an agent in there, and it produces large amounts. So, for example, you could genetically modify a strain of anthrax, and this laboratory will genetically modify organisms, aerosolize them, and perform rodent challenge tests. So you could take, you know, a strain of genetically modified anthrax and put it inside of the fermenter, and it could grow over 1,000 liters of that agent, which is an amount sufficient for a theater-scale war. These are the types of proliferation questions that occur when you locate a biowarfare agent facility inside of a nuclear weapons lab. And when you look at the larger political context, the Bush administration derailed negotiations of the Biological and Toxin Weapons Convention, which was trying to put a verification aspect into the treaty so that other countries would be able to verify compliance. Are other countries producing bioweapons, or are they using their biodefense as a smokescreen? This was the intention of the convention, and the Bush administration actually was the party that derailed these negotiations. So it's very suspicious that after that we're actually seeing a surge in these exact type of facilities.
We're going to have to end it right there, Tara. I really appreciate your time tonight. If listeners want to get more info, your website is?
www.trivalleycares.org. The complaint is up there, and we also have petitions. So we are still collecting petitions if folks want to send those in. And our phone number is 925-443-7148.
All right, Tara Darabji of Tri-Valley Cares. You're the outreach coordinator there, www.trivalleycares.org. That's TRIValleyCares.org. Thanks for joining me tonight on Rockin' the Boat.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Peaceful efforts to disarm the Iraqi regime have failed again and again. Weapons of mass destruction. Weapons of mass destruction. This is not a question of authority. It is a question of will. Weapons of mass destruction. Weapons of mass destruction. Saddam Hussein and his sons, must leave Iraq within 48 hours. Weapons of mass destruction. Weapons of mass destruction.
And you're tuned into Rockin' the Boat here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. We're going to move now into the Auntie Bee's Knees report for the week. She looks at U.S. government procurement for contracts increasing domestic surveillance systems. Auntie Bee's Knees coming up next.
Hello, this is Auntie Bee's Knees with your business report for the week of August 25th. The U.S. military-industrial complex is flying high as American corporations line up at the trough for lucrative government contracts to increase domestic surveillance. Funded by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, or DARPA, projects to monitor people's movements and identities are coming under fire from civil liberties advocates. But they're a boon for American defense contractors and technology companies, who will be profiting from the expanded capabilities of Big Brother. Companies are designing and perfecting new products in hopes of winning a role in the Department of Homeland Security's efforts to tighten security at U.S. borders by installing a computerized entry-exit system to collect fingerprints and photographs and run background checks on foreign foreign visitors. Congress first voted to set up an entry-exit tracking system in 1996, but business groups at the time were able to delay implementation of the program by raising concerns that it would hinder commerce. The attacks of September 11, 2001 muted such objections. Last April, Department of Homeland Security Secretary Tom Ridge announced the launch of the U.S. Visitor and Immigrant Status Indicator Technology, or U.S. Visit Program, an expansion of the National Secure Entry-Exit Registration System, or NSEERS, under the Directorate of Border and Transportation Security, the new office that brought customs, immigration, and transportation security under one umbrella. U.S. Visit's giant database and information network would record arrivals and departures at every U.S. port of entry, including more than 300 international sea, land, and air crossings. U.S. Visit would collect information including individuals' arrival and departure dates, nationality, immigrant status, full name, citizenship, sex, passport number and issuing country, country of residence, complete address while in the U.S., U.S. visa number, date, and place of issuance. The program will phase out NSEERS, a pilot project initiated after September 11, 2001, that requires all males over the age of 17 from 33 Middle Eastern, African, and Asian countries to be interviewed, photographed, and fingerprinted by immigration officers or face deportation. U.S. Visit will expand this procedure to apply to visitors from all countries. In order to track the more than 225 million visitors entering the U.S. each year, U.S. Visit will incorporate biometric identifiers at all ports of entry by 2005. Biometrics uses digital technology to verify an individual's identity by examining a unique physiological trait or behavioral characteristic such as fingerprints, DNA, voice, eyes, or facial structure, and comparing it to stored information. By January 1st of next year, visitors flying into a major international airport or arriving at seaports in the U.S. will have their travel documents scanned, their photograph and fingerprints taken, and attached to visas. Visitors will then be checked against a database containing lists of people who can be denied entry to the U.S., whether for immigration infractions, previous criminal charges, or connections to suspected terrorist groups. Officials have yet to announce what categories of visitors will be included in this first phase of U.S. Visit. Visitors from Canada, which leads all countries in the greatest number of visitors to the U.S. with 13 million travelers crossing the border last year, will not be subject to the program because the Canadian government has been actively collaborating with the Department of Homeland Security to share information on travelers entering the U.S. from Canada. Jim Williams, director of U.S. Visit, acknowledges that the program's scope is huge. Asa Hutchinson, Secretary for Border and Transportation Security, has said that he wants the information gathered by U.S. Visit to be shared with domestic law enforcement agencies, including local police. The U.S. budget allocated more than $425 million for the program this year. U.S. Visit's price tag is expected to amount to $2 billion or more over the next several years. The Department of Homeland Security has already awarded a five-year $60 million contract for U.S. Visit program management support to PEC Solutions, a major government contractor that has provided information systems support to the Department of Defense and the Drug Enforcement Agency. This company will provide support for the procurement process for U.S. Visit. The project's prime contractor will be announced next May. Several hundred contractors are lining up for a piece of the U.S. Visit pie, as was suggested by the standing room only crowd at a U.S. Visit industry conference held last month in Arlington, Virginia. Among the technologies that potential contractors hope U.S. Visit will incorporate are Crossmatch Technologies' portable fingerprint scanner to instantly capture and share fingerprints, Imaging Automation's document verifier to ensure that passports, visas, and driver's licenses are genuine, Security Identification System's tracking system for verifying passengers as they leave and reboard cruise ships at ports of call, and Kipper Technologies' retinal scanners. While these smaller companies may receive a fraction of U.S. Visit funds, only a handful of major U.S. defense contractors are considered large and established enough to be awarded the status of prime contractor, such as Lockheed Martin and Northrop Grumman. While the Department of Homeland Security is set to shell out cash for biometric surveillance at U.S. borders, the U.S. Department of Defense is planning to issue contracts for advanced video surveillance networks that could be used to track people's movements within those borders. Combat Zones at Sea, or CTS, is a $12 million three-year program being developed by the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, or DARPA, the same agency behind the notoriously invasive Total Information Awareness Program and the stock market for terrorism known as the Policy Analysis Market. CTS would coordinate surveillance cameras, gathering their views into a single database and highlighting unusual information in order to track anything that moves. Pentagon officials swear that the technology is for use on foreign battlefields, but critics warn that the components could easily be adapted to domestic surveillance. Currently, surveillance cameras are in use in every major American city. They record so much information that it is virtually impossible to compare and analyze their views to track changes. Many of these cameras record over their videotapes regularly, and officers who have to monitor the cameras struggle with with boredom and loss of attention. CTS hopes to automate the monitoring and analysis performed by surveillance cameras and security officers so that the images captured by surveillance cameras can be used to pinpoint unusual events and uncover links between places, objects, and times of activity. By 2005, CTS aspires to build the world's first multi-camera surveillance system using automatic analysis of live video to study vehicle movements and other events across a large area. CTS would keep watch by equipping each camera with a computer processor, programmed into video understanding algorithms that can distinguish one object from another, and by networking cameras together to track the movements of targeted vehicles and people. The technology for networking surveillance cameras to share information over a wide area is still in development, but a rudimentary version of CTS will be demonstrated at a U.S. military base in Virginia as early as next summer. The pilot program will use CTS technology to track the movement of cars on the base. At different checkpoints on the base, cars' speeds, times of arrival, color, size, license plates, and shape will be automatically passed on to a central server, where the information can be compared with a database of vehicles earmarked by security officials. If all appears normal, the cameras might only send basic information and the occasional low-res image to each other. But when something unusual happens, images could become more detailed and frequent. The following year, CTS should move on to a testing in an urban combat setting, where information will be gathered from 100 mobile sensors containing dozens of tiny cameras. There are a number of different military contractors working on CTS technology, each of whom could have a chance at DARPA's $12 million development contract to be awarded this week. Representatives from dozens of defense and technology companies showed up to hear DARPA officials outline CTS project goals last March, including executives from Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, Global Infotech, General Dynamics, BAE Systems, AlphaTech, Northrop Grumman, and Sarnoff Corporation. Software developer AlphaTech has developed a CTS simulation using surveillance cameras to track a car over a 10-kilometer area. Prototype software from Northrop Grumman and the Sarnoff Corporation would interrupt the gray monotony of surveillance footage with flashing red boxes to warn authorities of suspect behavior. The Sarnoff Corporation's video flashlight would morph different cameras' views into a single three-dimensional model. A security officer could then use a joystick to maneuver through this simulation, tracking vehicles and individuals in real time as though playing a game on Xbox. Spokesmen for both Sarnoff and Northrop Grumman assert that the primary application of their CTS technology is for domestic security. Nonetheless, DARPA denies that CTS would be used to track vehicles and individuals within the U.S., though one DARPA official has admitted that there is a chance the technology might find its way into domestic surveillance programs. Right to privacy advocates, who have already fought against the use of biometric facial recognition technology at the Super Bowl and against the use of surveillance cameras, are concerned about the potential impact of CTS technology if it is applied to civilians by commercial or government agencies outside the Pentagon. Other critics have different concerns with the focus on domestic surveillance at the Department of Homeland Security and DARPA. Over the past 2 years, billions of dollars have been spent by the Bush administration to monitor the movement of people in the U.S., to collect individuals' personal details, and to share information between local police and the Pentagon. Meanwhile, crucial infrastructure for emergency responses has been neglected. The U.S. government has dramatically increased its surveillance capacity, created huge interconnected databases of suspected terrorists, and launched a program to monitor airport and shipping passengers. But the same government has been very reluctant to give money to communities for dealing with actual emergencies. Over the last 2 years, the Federal Homeland Security Department awarded more than $4 billion to communities for domestic security. None of this was made available, for instance, for installing backup generators at Cleveland's water plants. When blackouts struck that region 2 weeks ago, the city was left without clean water for 15 hours. Other cities face critical staffing shortages and facility maintenance problems among local utilities, firefighting, medical, and law enforcement services. Yet, no federal funding has been made available for dealing with these crises. Instead, billions of taxpayer dollars are used to pay corporations for keeping tabs on the public at large. Consider that the defense sector is composed of companies that reach far beyond what most ethical funds consider to be weapons manufacturing. And check to make sure that your investments aren't paying for Big Brother to take your picture. Signing off, this is Auntie Bee's Knees reminding you to put your money where your mouth is and invest ethically.
And that's going to wind it up for us tonight here on Rockin' the Boat. Join me again tomorrow from 5:30 to 6 right here at 96.3 FM Free Radio Santa Cruz, www.freakradio.org.